I've known Dr. Tillman here primarily through Wake Forest. As I said in my email to you this week, Don has thought more deeply about the connection between his work and his faith than anybody in my experience. So I'm really glad you're here. We had a chance to work together on a project at Wake a couple of years ago in this very area, a quiet work conference. So Don, I'm delighted to have you here with us. I know it's a pleasure.
Thank you. Well, obviously I know a number of folks here, and some of them have been here to babble about for a long time. But it is very nice to be here with everyone. I'd like to make today a bit interactive, which will be biographical, but also, I think, enable everyone else to participate in that of my own autobiography in the sense that you may place yourself in that along the way and perhaps give me some additional feedback as we kind of think about this together. So, why don't I open with prayer for a second? Father, we are grateful for this gorgeous day that you've given us, a day in which we stop and worship you, where we gather as the body of Christ, and where we think about what it means to be your followers, and when we give you praise and honor. Thank you for this time together, and I pray, Father, that we may together, through your Holy Spirit, grow in the grace and knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ. Amen. Well, I'd like to start briefly, just give you a little personal narrative so you kind of see how I got where I got in life. So I think it may help a little bit. I was raised in Winston-Salem, and I was a church dropout. Fifth grade, I guess that's confirmation, and I came home to my parents, I'm believing it, I was one of them. So I guess I had enough wisdom to think of knowing you all enough to say that I probably looked at what happened. And I still remember the youth group went down to a Billy Graham thing, and I was the only person who didn't go forward. So it was interesting, but I still remember that. But in high school, met an organization called Young Life, y'all know quite well, and Young Life leader, I guess he took it upon himself to really crack me open. So he challenged me, I told him I didn't believe any of that. He said, well, what do you know about it? I said, I don't know, obviously you don't know anything. So he said, here's how you need to know something. You need to read the Bible for an hour every night for years. Then if you've done all that, you don't believe it. Then you've got to let you know what you're talking about. So I said, okay, I'll take that challenge. So I was 16-year-old and I'm going to read the Bible for an hour every night. So interesting thing happened near the end of that period. I started going to campaigners, but I still wouldn't believe it yet. But that was a time that sometimes it's referred to now as the Jesus movement time. So there's these friends of mine who went this house church thing, and they came home and they said, you know, you got to go to this night. This guy's something. So anyway, I got converted in that context. So I just kind of varied history of evangelicalism and charismatic world at that time. And then I go off to college, and I go to a church. Got started under a young pastor named Skip Ryan. You all may have heard Trinity Presbyterian in Charlottesville. Skip was heavily influential in my life and still is a quite close friend. He was a young pastor at the time, 28 years old or so. And so then from there, Skip was in the Reformed tradition, obviously, and so from there I went off to a place called Regent College in Vancouver, British Columbia to do a graduate work in biblical studies and philosophy. And read heavily in the Reformed tradition and was greatly influenced by much of that work. I say that because prior to that, in my own conversion experience, took place a great deal in the context of kind of a counterculture orientation. And that lent itself naturally to a very large split, you might say, in a secular spiritual mindset. So that the most meaningful activities were always religious activities, and the most powerful ones were always that kind of context of Bible studies and things we would do. And so at Reynolds High School, for instance, we decided to do this large assembly at the auditorium. We, you know, Billy Graham does these things. We have this institute, right? And it's really interesting that folks got involved with it. So we went down to the principal and asked if we could rent the auditorium for a night. And you know, he said yes, and I thought maybe that leave him now. But so we got this little group together, we got to praying. Well, what's Billy Graham doing? Well, you know, hey, somebody gives a couple talks, then they sing some songs, you know, and then somebody calls somebody for them. So, all right, then we'll try that too. And it's really a remarkable thing. In fact, the guy who actually did the, what he was called then, I suppose, an altar call, is now the number two guy in the Billy Graham Association. So, interesting how it happened. But, 800 people came, like 4,000 people came to Christ that night. And we started a Bible study in the school. Our young life went to over 500 people. I thought that was normal. Oh, that was in college. It sounded like that was normal. But in reality, that had a profound impact upon me in terms of the reality of the gospel. But in one sense, also, it probably drove a big cleavage between, okay, here's the religious sphere of life, and like here's the rest of life. The rest of life you just kind of do. This over here, this is where it really counts. So when I went to college and went to Skip's church, I really heard a kind of a different perspective. So I went off to, so my senior year in college actually was the first attempt. I wrote a paper on the infant study on Gustav Mahler, and wrote a paper on Mahler's spiritual anxieties and troubles and how it influenced the whole modern music atonal movement out of his own spiritual life. So I was at a second university and tried to reflect on the dimensions of Mahler's spiritual life from a Christian perspective. And it gave me a little courage to say, you know, I think I'm going to need to apply my whole life and mind to what we're trying to do here. So I went off to Regent and studied, came back, worked a few years, went back into my MBA at Wake. But really once I was at Regent, it became my real kind of quest in life to say, what does it mean to live faithfully for Christ in every sphere of life, at least the life where God placed me? And so that became the focus of my studies and my research and my life. And so in one sense, I guess you would say it was the closest analogy I can give, I suppose, what I try to do is a bit like an academic medical center. So you have research, and you have translation, and you have clinical practice all going on at the same time. So I try to keep my hands in all three of those areas along the way. Stay close to lots of faculty members at Regent and other academics around the United States and try to read heavily in those areas. I try to translate that into language that I think is more accessible than it is lots of times. And then I just try to live that along the way. So I've actually got a number of lengthy talks and stuff, but you know, there's a little boring. So I thought we might do something together that might capture what I've learned along the way a little bit and how it's kind of impacted me. And this is a thing I'm working on right now to help pastors know how to relate to people in the workplace. Most pastors significantly struggle with this. They either say extremely simplistic things that people roll their eyes about, or they say irrelevant things that don't connect at all. And so I'm working with a group of pastors to try to help them put together a construct of how to disciple folks in the workplace. And the problem is that they have a very simplistic view, and they don't understand what people are in their own career paths, and the questions they're asking are different at different places along the way. And if they're going to be serious about engaging the folks in the workplace, they've got to have different sets of questions. And then they also have to think about where those people are in their own spiritual life all the way. So there's different questions you ask of different people at different stages. So this little construct I've got here in front of you is really my own personal narrative in a more normative style. At least I fit within these frameworks a little bit as well. Along the top, if you look at operational, managerial, and executive, those are different places in a career path someone would be. So, and then down the left side captures kind of some stages, we may say, in terms of where you are in your own faith and what that looks like. And so, just for instance, to make you can be a new Christian as an executive, you can be a new Christian as an operational model. All right? Those have different consequences in terms of your levels of authority, your space and sphere of influence, and how you operate. And so if you're a pastor speaking in that situation, if you're a pastor speaking to people in an operational place of view, that has different ways and consequences because someone has got an executive enterprise-wide responsibility all the way down this. And so what I'd like to do is just take a few moments and then talk about this in my own life. And then I'm very comfortable if you'd like to ask any questions in any area. So how I think about living faithfully for Christ is captured in the Pauline or also Augustinian perspective of life of faith, hope, and love, or faith, love, and hope, and all the way. And that is how we give expression to who we are in that context. And in my own experience, I've learned and seen this kind of movement. So if you take down the left, we'll call it exercise faith, live love, and bring hope. This comes from both Peter's writings and Paul's writings primarily. In Peter's writings, in 1 Peter, you see we're called from darkness into his wonderful light, we're called to follow in his footsteps, and we're called to bless the world. Three callings in Peter's language. In Paul's language, you see regularly that we have a calling to salvation, a calling to sanctification, and a calling to service. I use them in a summary, kind of the movement of the Christian faith in the following way. We are called to behold him, believe in him, and belong to him. We are called to become like him and to bear his fruit. We are called to bless his world and bring his justice. Now, justice in the biblical sense is meaning to restore things to the way they were meant to be. So it has a sense of restoration. It has an eschatological view as well as what you're looking forward to. In the Old Testament, they use the language of shalom to be associated with that. So, exercising faith, the first dimension moving from darkness to light. My own experience is when one becomes a Christian in this particular context, it has a sense of altering perspective and purpose and motivation very quickly in life. And that's just a genuine conversion and engagement with Christ. We are reoriented from self to God. That reorientation of our lives from darkness to light alters how we engage the world around us. Now, for most of us in that initial steps, we're mostly aware of our own sin and self and how we begin to see ourselves dissonant with either practices in the past, which we did, or practices we see around us. Abraham Kuyper speaks of that in musical terms. He says, in growth in Christ, you begin to see yourself dissonant from the patterns of the world. Where before, you actually, he's describing it in a way that would be similar for a trained musician, who can hear tones that are not correct immediately, well, untrained people just sound fine to them. As you grow in Christ, you begin to hear the dissonance of the world more and more. Typically, it's a dramatic experience when folks actually come to knowledge of Christ the first time. They begin to be aware of their own motivations, their perspectives, as Martin Luther called, their curved in selves, what they look to themselves all the time. They become aware of idols in their own life for the first time, the good things they've raised, the ultimate concerns in their life. And they grapple with all those things. My own experience with that was that thinking about the very nature of my job, what was I there for? What was I supposed to be accomplishing? To whom was I really accountable? All those are the kind of issues that most Christians grapple with for the first time in their lives. If they're in a place where their community is really encouraging to do that. Now, in evangelicalism, we've done a nice job of doing that, talking about it in our home. For instance, what it means to be a father, what it means to be a husband. But we've done very poorly when we extend that beyond those boundaries. What does it mean for me to be a neighbor, a citizen, a worker, someone engaged in the world? And my deep desire is to say to folks, learning how to exercise faith as a believer is the first real steps to being offering genuine Christian orientation to the world. So what do I mean by exercising faith specifically as a Christian? Well, I think that the best model for us look at the life of Jesus and specifically to look at the temptations. You know, when we look at the temptations, there Jesus is obedient to what we should have been obedient. So the life of Jesus is really, in one sense, you can see a juxtaposition against the life of Israel. So Jesus is the one who actually did what Israel was supposed to have done. And so when we look at how Jesus resisted temptations, we see there the actual practice of an exercise of faith. So what did he do? And he was hungry and believed that the act of the will on his part was to, or he could have made something out of nothing and used his own will. He said that we don't live by bread alone, but by the word from the Lord. So word, that context means that God is the source of all things in this world. And it begins with the perspective of humility. That we are not the source of any good thing in this world, and we are completely dependent upon Him. And so we begin every single day with that absolute commitment of dependence. Secondly, if we look at the next temptation where Jesus was, in Luke's account, Jesus brought to the top of the mountain and says, you could be ruler of all this. And you know, a lot of times when we think about Jesus, we have to put ourselves in that. And I don't know about you all, but I've been very fallen imagination. I'm saying, boy, if I was ruler of all the world, what would I do? You know, Jesus was perfect. So in real sense, Jesus could have actually exercised extraordinary leadership in that context. He could have solved the problems of the world. He had all power. He had all access to power. He had all wisdom. And yet, why didn't he do that? Because that was not his vocation. And so we find this over and over later in Jesus' writings, in the New Testament writings, not my will, but thy will be done. That was not why he was sent. So this profound sense of giving up your personal agenda in life and the rhythm associated with that giving upness is core to this dimension of exercising faith. And then lastly, when he's told to come now, throw yourself down and test the Lord that care for you. Of course, it goes back to the Old Testament where the Israelites were, you know, testing God and not sure and not willing to entrust themselves to his care. We found on the last statement of Jesus on the cross, which is, into my hands, I commit your spirit, and I commit my spirit. And so in our life, this movement of humility, of all things come from Him, this not my will, but your will be done, and this entrusting of the self are the basic rhythms of exercising faith. And they're the basic rhythms we take to the workplace every day in our own lives. We learn to pray in the workplace, pray for others, pray for our work around us. We learn to practice His presence, and we learn to entrust ourselves to Him. And believe that He is there in the workplace. That has different meanings at different stages, I mentioned, in career. When I first started this way, I was working in one of our service departments in one of our dealerships. I had no authority over anybody effectively. And so my calling was to say, in the space I have, what does it mean to redeem this for Christ? And I learned that from a Catholic journal that I'd read, where the Catholics were talking about more better on incarnational theology than most Reformed folks are. So it was a story of a woman who bagged groceries. And most of us wouldn't hold that up as the most esteemed vocation we dreamed of doing with the rest of our lives. But that was the space God had given her in life. And so, she bagged groceries to the glory of God. And every time someone came through, she engaged them, looked them in the eye, tried to bless them, asked them how they were doing. And people found themselves strangely attracted to her. And they would start sharing things about their life with the lady back groceries. And the lady back groceries would say she would pray for them. And every week they'd come back through, she'd say, you know, how's that son doing up we prayed for last week? We had a lot better week. Or, you know, praise the Lord, what can I do for you this week, you know? And, of course, time unfolds, and it's hard to talk about it. It really messed the supermarket up because everybody's getting in her line. I'm like, really? They're going in her line. So, you know, time of passes, and she retires, and she passes away, and you can imagine the storyline, which is you would expect a funeral from a woman like that to be sparsely attended, but of course it didn't happen. People turned out everywhere, and what they did was just give testimony to how this woman, nobody really knew, had really blessed their lives. Because what she did, she said, God's given me 6 feet. How can I redeem the 6 feet he's given me? She wasn't angry about the fact that she wasn't running the supermarket. She said, you know, I entrust myself to God. He's given me this feet in life. What does it mean for me in this space and time to live faithfully for him? So purpose and perspective and motivation are the beginning of exercising faith. What does that mean for our lives? So I had, in that workplace in those times, in those days, I can remember praying all the time for wisdom and direction and what it meant to really try to live for him in that place. And I had some characters to work with when I worked with. I had two guys who were in the Harley Davidson, in the Hells Angels, and they brought guns to work one day. Oh, Lord, what have I got involved with here? But, you know, saying, what does it mean to come alongside them and demonstrate that I care for them as real people? And that brings me to the next point, perspective here, which I call incarnation or live love. And what does it mean to become like him and bear his fruit? Our real calling into the estimate of terms of what we're supposed to be. And so I've got three things listed here: character, leadership, and culture. And I've got a little handout that will capture for me what that's meant. And how I think about that as a Christian. So character as a Christian begins with wanting to be like Jesus, because that's our ultimate aim and purpose of life. So if you look at what John says about Jesus, he came full of truth and grace. Now, truth and grace held together are very unusual in our world, because we like to be truthful lots of times, but we like to be graceful towards that. And this has some cultural distinctions. For instance, if you're from New York, you love being truthful. If you're from the South, you like to be graceful, but not truthful. You know, people made a fortune writing Southern novels about how nice everybody is, but of course, nobody's telling anybody the truth all the time. But you know, Jesus came from truth and grace. So if you think about the opposite, though, think about this in the quadrant. So we have truth on one side, and we have what we'll call relativity on the other side. And so we have grace on one side, and then we have legalism on the other side. So you can have four boxes with that. So if you have truth and legalism, you end up with an exhausting, performance-oriented environment around you that is, in religious terms, known as fundamentalism usually. But in organizational terms, you can have short-term success, but it burns folks out. And by the way, it burns out marriages too. If you have on the other side of this, relativity and grace, then you get narcissism and self-absorption, because you just absorb grace all the time. So people extend grace to it, you absorb it, has no change upon your life, because there's no truth associated with it. I think about Jesus, the woman of the well, go and sin no more. So there's grace and truth. If you look at all, it's very interesting. You look at all these interactions in the New Testament, you see both always held together. It's just fascinating. Truth and grace. Lived out his life. Always hospitality, always welcome, and always truthful. And we find it hard to do both of those in our lives many times. So what are the aspects of truth? You've got trust, integrity, and faithfulness, compassion, hospitality, and forgiveness. Those aspects of the character of a Christian that are really distinctive and in the mark of the Holy Spirit. It's not moralism. Moralism is not renewing, life-giving. Truth and grace is life-giving. It's freeing and alters people and organizations. And so creating space for that in your organizational life, how you live with that, how you live to be compassionate, how it means learning to exercise forgiveness in the workplace. and to be upfront about that. We talked about our company, how to give second chances to people. And what it means to have the great basis of who you are, sense of trust and integrity and faithfulness. Leadership. For me, to understand leadership comes from three words from the Bible of servant, priest, and pastor. So this is a distinctive Christian perspective on leadership. So servant means that we equip others. And the equipping of others is for them to fulfill their vocation to serve the common good. So it's not for them to self-fulfill, because their vocation is not for self-fulfillment. Their vocation is to, again, serve outside beyond themselves. And so the use of power exists in the workplace to equip others. And you exercise power as a servant. We are called as Christians to be priests. Priest means first bearing burdens for the people of God and the people of this world, and bringing God to the world and the world to people. So that involves our prayer life. It involves how we engage people around us. It means how we absorb people's pain and we don't give pain to people. And how we're in place that we are the first to disadvantage ourselves. In the Old Testament, the book of Proverbs is really a book of training of young rulers of Israel. And there's some words there that if we can retranslate them into languages we're more used to, it'll help us. So the righteous in the book of Proverbs are those who are willing to disadvantage themselves to the advantage of the community. The wicked are those who advantage themselves to the disadvantage of the community. So the righteous bring life to the community, and the wicked destroy the community. They destroy trust in the community. So if we're going to be folks who are willing to be, who are called to be righteous folks, we're called to be, in a sense, pastors as well, who build community by being willing to disadvantage ourselves as it relates to the community. So Christians, following the mind of Christ in Philippians 2, always are willing to open themselves up and empty themselves. So that brings, obviously, in the mind, it pushes greatly against the way of the world, doesn't it? Because Christians are always aware of the temptation that happened in Babylon, the desire to go out and make a name for ourselves. But our calling as Christians is to follow the way of Jesus, to follow in his steps, as Peter said, and as John said as well. And his steps, first step was to empty himself, to lead the perfect communion with the Father, Son, the Holy Spirit, to come as Jesus into this world and empty himself. So servant, priest, and pastor are the distinguishing marks of Christian leadership. They grow over time. They grow as we go down this ladder together and as we learn together in community. One of the great tragedies of the Christian church, in my opinion, is we are not intentional about developing distinctively Christian leaders. The Catholic Church was more orientated towards that than the monastic movement. Effectively, that was what their role was, specifically the Jesuits. Very disciplined in the process of saying there's a discipling to creating folks who are exercising leadership. Loyalist spiritual exercises, all those are deeply embedded spiritual exercises to bring forth mature Christian leaders. Not just leaders in the church, but mature Christian leaders who engage the world around them. And it's not something you just get up one morning and say, well, I'm going to be like Jesus and run outside now. Just like athletes train for years and years, this should take place in the context of the community of Christ, where there's mentoring going on, there's engagement going on, and lifelong relationships going on. It's been my great gift in my life to have had this happen over my entire life. And I've been related to folks now in their late 80s, been invested in their life, many of them are quite young, and have stayed with me along the way. And then culture. So the culture that we live and work in. So what is culture? Here's an easy way to describe it. It's like what water is to fish. You can't really see it, but we all know it's there. We're all living in it. And unfortunately, there are all these guys who are on the dog and pony show that you hire them, they're going to come and make a cultural change in your workplace in a weekend. And the folks who study this tell you this, you know, at least a 5-year effort. Because culture really deals with 3 deep dimensions. And that is purpose, significance, and community. Which, by the way, just happened to fall at first to Augustine's language that the 3 greatest, deepest human needs in life are faith, hope, and love. Intrinsic to the human condition, made in the image of God. Purpose is really, is there something worth believing in this workplace? Because if there's not something worth believing in the workplace, we get cynicism. So I go and help friends who own business from time to time, come and look at their businesses and talk about it. One of the first things I do is come out of radar or antenna off to say, let me talk to folks, because when you hear cynicism, it really, at the end of the day, they're saying, this is, there's nothing here. Nobody keeps the word. It's not like it's supposed to be. It's not the United States right now. Or it's always going to be like this. Nothing will really change. Significance is, do I personally make a difference? When I come to work every day, does the work I do make a difference? So one of the guys who mentored me along the way once told me when I was young that accountability was the greatest gift you could ever give anyone. Well, I played sports in high school and college, and accountability meant if you didn't do what you said on the bench. So I thought, like, a great gift. I'll get that. He said, because that means their work counts. Imagine working 30 years in a place and you weren't accountable, which meant that your work didn't count. Nobody cared what you did all day. What a devastating life that would be. And so great leaders actually create a higher accountable organization. So they understand the real difference they make, that their work makes. And of course, we understand that from Paul's language, remember one of another. So we use this language regularly in our company to talk about we are organic whole. Every member must contribute. So we work very hard not to actually use the language of employees, we use the language of members of an organization. So members like arm, leg, et cetera, take the leg off and you know, you can't perform. There's a little story we use in our training to talk about like most of these guys who know the name or people dated now, Deion Sanders. So Deion Sanders is like the greatest defensive back in college football history. Bobby Bell is the best player for Florida State. Some of the people think he was the best NFL defensive back. He retired because he was a big coach. Didn't know anymore. So he was the fastest defensive back ever. Heard his big toe. Couldn't see his toe at all. Couldn't run anymore. Profound impact to say there's no part of the body that doesn't count. So there's no part of the organization. So in my opinion, Christian leaders have a very strong orientation about helping every single person understand how they contribute, recognizing every single person in the workplace for that contribution. And community means do I belong? Am I connected? So we talk about, it's very important to recognize the difference between community and family. And Christians struggle with this sometimes because we want to appropriately, and we'll talk about this in a moment, personalize. Okay, we want to personalize because we're all made in the image of God. So the metaphor we know best is the family metaphor. But you know, in a family, performance doesn't matter, at least if you have a healthy family, it doesn't matter. You can't be expunged. Thomas has his mom and dad's DNA. There's nothing he can do that they can go, you know, we don't really know you. Yes, you do. Forever. And that passes down forever and ever. Well, in a workplace, that's not the case. Because a workplace, the organization, the risk organized, that is, it's organized for a purpose. So if you take the word community, of course, the etymology, that's pretty easy, common unity. It's a group of people organized for a purpose. And so our calling is to fulfill that purpose. If we fail to fulfill our purpose, we no longer have a reason to exist. And so everyone has to understand how to contribute to that purpose as a common unity. And so the language of leadership spends a lot of time framing that, helping people understand that, and understanding what your specific calling is. And why you've been organized and why you're together along the way. By the way, that is dealing with both operational, managerial, and executive. What is my calling if I'm running this machine? To understand what that really is and think of how I fit and my role I play in the whole context. So in transformation. The reason I have this last and bring hope is in my own life and what I've observed is that there's a desire many times to jump down here, and that is a fairly unattractive position before the world because it has a certain hardness and edginess to it. Because the folks had not gone through the first two movements of grace, which we'll call the exercise of faith and living love. So this desire, and often gets manifested in politics and power, and the power is not the way of truth and grace, of laying down your life for another first. Bringing hope, blessing his world, and bringing forth his justice means re-envisioning, resisting, and reweaving. Re-envisioning means, how do we begin to think about the workplace and the nature of our business in different ways? Resisting means pushing back against the world's influence upon us in terms of categories and idols of the world, but resisting in a way that comes out of love. So it's a humility associated with that resisting. There's not a hardness and an edginess to it, but there's a way that comes from that who's learning how to lay down his life and live love. Then there's this reweaving where you actually begin to work towards this restoration and begin to think about what that means in a different way. So let me take a few moments if I can and talk some about how we try to do that and how I try to do it in my own life along the way. So we have three foundational principles to our company. Called covenant with our customers, community with one another, and a commitment to the common good of our cities. And we try to use those as the building block of everything we do in our company along the way. Everybody is measured that way. Everybody is rewarded that way. And we start with the language of covenant about what it means to build a place of trust that keeps its word, is held accountable to that, and is willing to disadvantage itself to ensuring that takes place. That means that's the ways we do business that are different outside of our industry and our real commitment to try to sustain that every day. It requires starting with a category of very personal language. So, for instance, in a training program we have, when we talk about how we want someone to be treated, and we talk about as a value plan, as a neighbor brought over, what that would look like, and I summarize it in a couple ways. One would be, so when you go home and you speak with your family around the table and they ask you, what did you say or do today? Is there anything that you would be embarrassed or ashamed to tell them? Because if there is, you're doing the wrong thing in our company. And then, this is chauvinistic, but it reflects a little bit of our culture, I think, so forgive me when I say, how many of you would be willing to send your mother, your wife, or your daughter out of company without any counsel at all or coaching to buy a car from one of our dealerships? If anybody cringes, I say, then you're doing something wrong. Because we can never be a place that takes advantage of anybody under any circumstance. We have to be a place that, in fact, does the opposite in all circumstances. So we have all these kind of guidelines we have towards profit margins and so that you don't ever take advantage of somebody's trust. In fact, you always go the opposite way with that along the way. People have been very grateful, very rewarding to us as a company for this kind of things. And our Honda dealership has been ranked first in the United States two of the last 3 years in customer satisfaction. BMW dealership is only two on the planet Earth and received Center for Excellence like 10 times in the last 12 years. Our Audi dealership, I get a number of them. And so I get tons of conversation with customers regularly about this. And yes, we fall short. What we try to do is to say, the sun never goes down an upset customer. And if a person leaves without a smile, we want to act on immediately. So a lot of energy towards that. We have a whole staff that just works on that. And we have our guys have almost unlimited authority to address the situation with that context. So try to reduce our service business. We try to think about that difference as a contract commitment to customers, so we don't charge for second repairs if they don't fix it right the first time, the time problems, so a whole variety of things. So we say that's our fault. Again, we should be disadvantaging ourselves to advantage of our customers. And unfortunately, we can have a long-term view of that. So community with one another, how do we work that inside of our workplace? So we have a number of things to really try to focus on that. Obviously, we do kind of community events together all the time inside the community building events. And we have tons of bowling teams and softball teams and engagements together. We do parties together all the time. I've gone to hundreds of baby showers and weddings and funerals and birthday parties all the way. But we also have an internal bank that we put money in every year, and every company elects someone democratically to represent them on the board of that bank. And if an employee has an emergency, think about it like your Deacon's Fund, we just fund it. So it's up to $10,000 per occurrence. You know, a lot of people don't know it costs almost $10,000 to die. And so we'll have an entry-level worker whose parent passed away, and they don't have enough money to pay for a funeral. So our internal bank just makes it grants along the way. We have a foundation for scholarships. So all of our employees' children get scholarships to college. We pay for all of them to go to college in our company. So enough to pay for State University, Indian State University. We want to invest in the future of our families, and we felt like that was really important thing for us to be doing along the way. We have whole career paths and training programs for guys to go through so that we can do everything possible to ensure that if they invest their labor capital with us, that they get a just return on their investment along the way. So we have many 20, 30, 40-year employees in our organization who really invested their lives with us, and we think we have a profound moral responsibility for them along the way. We have lots of recognition programs, but all the recognition programs always recognize the core values we have that we build upon and describe here in terms of this relationship to our customer. And then our third is commitment to our communities, in which we live. We have, we think about this kind of commitment in from the Shalom model, and also the Greek understanding of the polis, which actually are very similar. So, to use the language, the Greek language, they say there are five conditions for the city to flourish: good, truth, beauty, justice, and plenty. The same, good in the Old Testament, found the same language there. So that's Shalom, when life is fully flourishing, it was meant to be, and as we hope for it to be someday. So today, you would think about that language slightly differently. We would say that the good is social capital. We would say truth is intellectual capital. Beauty is aesthetic capital. We live in a capitalist society. And justice is political capital. And plenty is economic capital. So what we do is try to break that orientation down and invest in each one of those areas in our communities which we're in. And I'll be very explicit about that. So in social capital, our company is the largest giver to United Way of the United States in our category. And on a per capita basis, we have 60 members of leadership. I mean, we have technicians giving $2,000, $3,000 a year. And they're all involved in programs throughout the city. We have a community day where, first off, if you volunteer as a time, you get paid for the time you volunteer. So if you go out during the day for 8 hours and you go work on something, you actually get paid during that period to go invest your life back in the community you live. We have another thing we do in social capital, of course, we build Habitat Homes as a company. We have a great time, and it's a wonderful leveler of the relationships of authority and power because, I'm not the best person to have in the company. As you can imagine, I mean, guys work on cars. They're like 10 times better, So, I'm like, rendered, like, don't want to touch that. You'll screw that up. That's great. I mean, we built 5 Habitat Homes as a company in about 6 or 7 years. And we built the whole thing. They don't have anybody else except us building all the way through. So our guys come to do it. We started a program when I was very concerned about the housing situation in our city. And so I went up to Ron Durego and worked for a period of time with the Center of Economic Self Alliance and Katie Little Foundation, West Salem Foundation. And our company underwrote a program to get folks in housing. So, but unlike what you read about in the paper that was destroyed, people had to go through a one-year program of personal budget. They had to do a budget every single year, keep every month, keep all the receipts. They had to save money every single month. We got the banks to open up, saving and checking accounts for them for free. Because, you know, for them, saving $50 a month, once they could get it, was a lot of money. And we have now put 400 people in homes. And our company underwrites the administration of that every year. And we've got the government to put second mortgages on, and we get these banks to do things all the way, and we've got to remain the long United Ways relationships to be able to put more together. I guess we looked at East Winston, and frankly, we said, you know, those are all great homes 50 years, 60 years ago when they're built, but we have not recreated wealth again in our city. And so, how do we go about that, and how do we, you know, take our resources? So we've tried to think about this in the art world as well and invest in local artists and play the art along the way. In economic development, we try to think in terms of the community and the common good and the creation of jobs and wealth in communities along the way. So I had a professor at Regan College who's actually been at this church named Bruce Walke. And so Bruce challenged me to go to the book of Proverbs and kind of retranslate it using the language of the day that would be appropriate. So this is my translation of a number of Proverbs that I call it true wealth. Those who serve the needs of the community create true wealth. Poverty comes to those who serve themselves. The destroyer of trust earns money by deceptive practices. Those who serve the needs of the community will be rewarded. Those who gain wealth by taking advantage of another deserve condemnation. Wealth gained at the expense of another destroys all those involved. The income of those who serve the needs of the community renews their life. The income earned by those who destroy trust ultimately destroys everyone. Wealth that is derived from destroying trust is of no value to the community. But those who give of themselves in service to the community bring life to everyone. So that's my understanding of what it means to live faithfully for Christ in the workplace. It means living in a pluralistic setting. So it means, in a sense, being missionaries. You are sent out to represent Christ in that setting. And so what it means to live there as an ambassador for Christ, to help people envision what work can be like in real work. But it's lived in the messiness of real life, the ups and downs of life, the caring of life, but it is, in my opinion, the place we are meant to live our life. And that it's quite unfortunate that we basically embraced a fairly platonic perspective and emerged through the church that broke apart the spiritual and the secular dimensions of life. And we worked very hard, and I have in my own life, to say, how do I reintegrate those two together? And so that the real quest is saying, what does it mean to live faithfully for Christ, to be a presence for Him in the context where He has put me, which changes over time and seasons of life, changes the levels of authority and where we are, changes with different places. So my calling in the workplace can be different from my calling as a citizen or my calling as a neighbor. One place I may have different levels of authority, and I have to grapple with how I exercise an authority and use that power in a servant model. So we've got about 7, 8, 10 minutes left. If any questions anybody wants to ask, please feel free. And if there's anything I haven't touched on or you'd like me to touch on more or you want to question me about it, challenge me, please feel free to do so.
How does your immediate family get on board with what you have set in a leadership role? You know, for some of your wife and your children.
So it's a great gift to me, and my wife has been my partner. Mm-hmm. and we met when we were younger, so it helped in some sense. She, my narrative, her narrative lived together. So we prayed and lived and worked and wrestled with these things, and she really has both enabled us and encouraged me in it, and joined me in lots of it, in the sense seeing us as together and trying to do this. So there's got to be some hitch up.
As far as hiring your manager, run all the field trips, what process do you go through to?
So we have
a,
it's got to be torturous for these guys. You know, first they go through all the kind of aptitude things that they've done today and all that. And then they spend a lot of time with me. And we talk a lot. I mean, some of them are like, who can leave? They're like, it is not where I want to work. So I have like, man, a lot. It's like way too much. Way too, I just want to go and sell some cars. What the heck? That's all this stuff about. But, you know, over time, we, you know, it's pretty remarkable. I had two experiences recently that were really gratifying. One wife told me that her husband's life had been changed by working with me along the way and changed as a husband. And then the other one's humorous. The daughter of one of the guys who works for me, she had come home with a report card and had very good grades except for one conduct thing, and the person said to him, well, we need to celebrate all these things and be grateful for all the things that you've done well in here, and then we need to ask ourselves, how could we improve in this next area? What goals would we have for ourselves? And she said, Daddy, you're selling Mr. Flutterbell. So we have this whole process. We have kind of a leadership model we have. We call serve. That's the model we train in. We call show respect, earn trust, reach for perfection, value input, energize others. So show respect comes from this deep commitment we have that we first made in the image of God. And so we talk about what this means to show respect and the fact that you don't earn respect, you show respect. You earn trust. And, for instance, the way the world says you earn respect. And the way you do that, because, see, the world says that people are instrumental, right? So you earn respect based on what you've done, as opposed to saying on who you are. And so we go through this process, and you know, there's lots of non-Christians kinds of conversations, like, well, I mean, no, I don't believe that. You know, you've got to earn my respect. And so, is that right? So, when you held your child the first time and they cut the umbilical cord and you looked at them in your hands, did you go, son, you're going to need to earn my respect? You didn't say that, did you? So flash forward 21 years. What happened? So what did the first thing you said? You said, I love you. I embrace you. I care about you as a person. So it's appropriate to say you have to earn somebody's trust. You're a fool if you trust someone. Here's everything I have. I've never met you before, but I just trust you. Now, you earn trust, but you show respect. We talk about reaching for perfection because we'll never get that. But, you know, that's what the world was meant to be like. So what does it need to look like if it was done properly? And then continue to indict yourself. And everybody wants to lower it. They're like, oh, man, it's a... Now, you need to hold that tension there in front of us all the time to say, what would the ideal look like? And then always value input. So it... And I try to model that, lots of input, lots of opportunities for input. And then the sense of energizing others, of giving confidence of others, of unleashing other people's giftedness in the workplace and allowing them to get expression of that. So we talk about the difference in running out of gas in a car and running out of gas in an airplane. So it should be a normal occurrence in our company running out of gas in a car. You pushed a little bit too far, you tried something new, it didn't quite work out. How do you learn from it if you ever run out of gas in a car? Thomas, if you're not pickles, Thomas, if your mom and dad ran out of gas in the car, you're going on a trip. Okay. You get on with you. Mom and dad, like, what are y'all doing? I don't know what you're doing, you know, so you learn from it. It's a little embarrassing. I actually did this one time. My family had to hike up to the gas station, get a can, buy a can, hike back down, hitchhike along the road. I'll never do that again, man. I don't know that. So you learn from it, right? So we talk about your accountable to excelling. We call excelling go as far as you can with what your gifts are. And you're accountable to learning, but you're not accountable to perfection. If I'm accountable to perfection, then I'm going to sit in this chair and never move, because I can pretty much sit here and not screw things up. But we're accountable for learning and trying. Now, if we're going to run out of gas in an airplane, I want to be involved, because you don't really get a second chance. But because you got to create space for folks to really give expression to that. So last thing I'm going to talk about engaging the world around you. So the language I use personally is kind of three-fold approach. So thoughtful affirmation, critical accommodation, and humble and graceful resistance. So anytime we engage in the world and we affirm something, we still need to affirm it thoughtfully. We need to be careful in saying what are the points of alignment, and there's always points of disalignment in that setting. So be aware of who we are in the context of what's going on. Critical accommodation, okay, that's the way of Joseph, the way of Daniel. You will accommodate yourself. So you have to be critical and be very aware of it, knowing what's going on. Have someone else holding you accountable. I know I'm doing this right now. I need you to walk with me to make sure that you can spot it out. And when we resist, we need to resist in the way of Jesus. It needs to be a humility and a gracefulness to our resistance. You don't need to be screaming and hollering as Christians. You don't need to bother the heck out of me when I look at television. I hear the secular side and I hear the religious side and politics. I can't tell the difference. They talk the same way. Instead of saying, where is the side that is the aroma of Christ? It's so attractive. The person says, you know, I completely, utterly disagree with you and incredibly admire and respect you. See, that is the way of Christ that offers a whole new path in for us as believers in the world and engage in the world around us. Any other questions?
What do you really, I mean, you're not the executive. You've done everything within the company.
Right.
So when you're sitting and you have all these different areas you spoke about, which
right.
is, the community and
right.
different things your company does, but when you, on a yearly basis or when you, now where you are, what do you really enjoy about what you get to do? Like, what do you, is it going out and playing baseball? You know, what is it that you think, oh, that's just great that I get to do that?
No, that's a great question. I just finished, and we'll talk about that. So when I was younger, I loved that what gave me joy was kind of, I call it doing things. Doing new things, trying to do those things, you know. Kind of the next stage was really about new ideas and new ways of thinking. And now really it's about people. Extraordinary joy I see of investing in folks' careers and their lives and engaging them and seeing them time. I now have no perspective of time and seeing what happened. It's just, extraordinary experience. It's a gift, a grateful gift to be and engage with people like that along the way. And I, last year, automobile business was like once every 50 years, and that's too many. And the reaction of our company was just extraordinary. So we got together and we said, this is really horrible. And our lead bank walked out because one busted, and General Motors looks like it's going bankrupt too. Yeah. That time we had 16 General Motors franchises. Around the state, this is going to be ugly. If Wacoby goes down, we're out of business totally. So I started doing these webcasts every week and talking to our whole company, where we were, what was going on. I tried to be in the workplace all day, every day, from 7 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock at night. Trying to bring confidence to setting, listening, engaging, and one thing we did was said, look, we got to save money, and here's what we got to look at. Every time we save $4,000 in a month, we kept somebody's job. Just using us around, but we kept somebody's job. So how do we save $4,000? We run the whole company up in small groups, and everybody came forth with ideas all over the place to do things. It was just unbelievable. The people, employees wrote me notes, members of the organization wrote me personal notes every week, and encouraging things to me personally, so it was an extraordinary experience when starting out and involved folks in our company to have that kind of engagement with people along the way. But, it's something I tried to mention earlier. It doesn't happen in 1 week. long road of obedience of life. And the sadness for me is that Christians haven't really, in their churches, haven't been encouraged in this. And so they ought to say, what does faithful presence look like for you in your workplace? On a week, daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, over a 10-year period of time, engage in the sets of relationships and the work in the, of itself and the people in that organization. By the way, Paul Stevens is one of those mentors to me all the way. He's been for about 20 years.
Thank you.